This episode is brought to you by Atlassian. Atlassian software like Jira, Confluence, and Trello help power global collaboration for all teams so they can accomplish everything that's impossible alone. Because individually we're great, but together we're so much better. Learn how to unleash the potential of your team at Atlassian.com. Atlassian.com. Atlassian. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more.
There's no better feeling than a personal win. And the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello there, Chris Skoll here from Quickly Kevin. Now look, we're all desperately sad that Quickly Kevin is ending in a few weeks. But if there is room in your heart for another podcast, you may want to check this one out. It's called Oh What a Time. It's hosted by myself, along with fellow Quickly Kevin alumni Tom Crane and Ellis James. And every week we look at a different aspect of history and try and figure out what it would have been like to have lived through that. I'm really holding back the temptation to say it's a sideways look at history, because I feel that is a well-worn phrase. But nevertheless, it is a history podcast with a difference. Episodes come out every Monday and Tuesday at the minute. We've been going since August last year. There's loads of episodes to catch up on. If you want to check it out, check it out. But I thought what we would do on the feed, on the Quickly Kevin feed today, is just give you a little taster of it. And what you're about to hear is the best bits from episodes from last year. But we've been going this year. There's the episodes, brand new episodes every week. So see what you think of this. Hopefully you might like it. Hopefully there is room in your heart for another podcast. And hey, this could be it. If you're into history, and there is lots of references to 90s football crowbarred in. See if you can spot them. Here comes the best bits. See what you think. It's called Oh What a Time.
I got heckled a little bit, and
a little bit.
Let's just say boys will be boys, and I absolutely neutralised my opponent. Now, he was quite pissed off with me, to the extent that he followed me into the car park, right?
No.
And yeah. And he wanted to have a scrap, and I thought, oh my god. Now, happily for me, whilst Tom Crane may or may not have been on the bill, I can't remember. We definitely did that gig together. I can't remember if it was that night. The person who was on the bill was a Canadian prop act called Rex Boyd.
Oh, yeah.
Who, his big closer was, he used to juggle with machetes. Mm-hmm. So I said, Jesus Christ, that sort of that bloke in the grey coat, he's coming after me in the car park, Rex. And Rex said, don't worry about it, I've got these. He pulled his machetes out and walked me back to my car.
Oh, that's absolutely amazing.
I think I've told you about this, Ellis, did a corporate that went so badly I got hit on the head with a Volavon.
Yes, I remember
that. Yeah, that was a low one.
What, thrown
from the back.
Thrown at you.
Yeah. And I said, stop doing that. You're wasting your food, as a joke. And he said, it's a buffet. There's plenty where that came from.
Oh, no.
Oh, my God. Isn't that Brian Connolly's catchphrase? It's a buffet. Pop culture,
Ellis,
reference for the kids.
Ellis, question. Did I win them round after that?
No. Did you win them round after that?
No, absolutely not. No. You better think it got worse.
Any sense of authority you had, I'm doubting you had very much, had gone.
So, it was a really inopportune reminder that there is a buffet instead of this.
So, Chris, back to the history, away from my show.
Hecklers, they're often spontaneous, or so you imagine, but if you trod the boards in 19th century France, it's likely you would hear interruptions that were planned and undertaken by professionals.
Wow.
I've never heard of this. This has blown my mind. I'm so excited to tell you about it. Have you heard of the clackers?
No.
You ever heard of these?
No. Obviously, you heard of stooges in the audience.
Well, this a very professional set, these were. The clackers, as they were known. A group of people hired to applaud a performance. So who exactly was the clacker? This is from one French newspaper contemporary source. The clacker is an applauder employed by the management to stoke the success of a piece of theatre or an artist.
Wow.
They continued. The clackers constitute, along with the actors and the audience, the three indispensable elements of the theatre. Today, the age of ovation is over. The public, the real public, no longer applauds. They do not take the trouble to applaud. They are afraid of soiling their trousers or reddening their hands. They no longer cry out. They murmur bravo instead to avoid growing hoarse. The clackers are the result of these habits. The clackers will howl, stamp their feet, etc.
Wow.
The clackers were massive. At the largest venues, the entire operation might involve anywhere between 100 to 150 clackers. In smaller ones, 50 to 70 clackers. The least number of clackers was 30 at any one time. Would you have appreciated some when we hit the road with Oh What a Time live shows? Can we get some 30 clackers in there?
I think, to be honest, it's imperative that we get 30 clackers. all cheering us in French accents.
I think I'd be a bit hurt if I turned up to do a tour show and the theatre said to me, "Don't worry, it's 75% clackers." We could see how this is going to go.
Oh, you think I'm going to absolutely bloody rip this? So the clacks were well organised. There was a boss, the chef d'attack, who marshalled proceedings and could become very famous indeed. Below them, there were lieutenants who rang brigades that spread out within the theatres and sergeants below them. The man credited with inventing the clack as a method of ensuring appreciative audiences in the theatre was the 16th century poet Jean Durat, who gave freebies to would-be patrons in return for their claps and cheers when the curtain fell. Such was the success of Durat's invention that rivals soon became very jealous, and they too employed clackers for their performances. And then it was realised, I don't know if you saw this coming, I didn't, but this is what happened next is incredible. They then realised it inevitably that clackers didn't need to just clap. They could potentially boo as well. They could interrupt as well as applaud.
Amazing.
They could harm a production as well as encourage it, all for the right level of financial return. Can someone smell a protection racket coming on?
No.
Wow.
So they threatened. They said, if you don't pay us, we're going to start booing.
Exactly that. I'll move on to that. By the 19th century, the clackers had developed into such a phenomenon within French theatre that they were professionally organised.
What a job.
I know.
Oh, good to see you, mate. It's been ages. How are the kids getting on? Abigail's studying midwifery, so we're very, very proud of her. And my son, Ryan's a clacker. Actually, is he? Yeah, he prefers the booing, if he's totally honest.
This episode is supported by FX's Clipped, the scandalous story of the 2014 Clippers owner's racist remarks captured on tape and heard around the world. The series charts the tape's impact on a dysfunctional basketball organization striving to win against their reputation as the most cursed team in the league. Starring Lawrence Fishburne, Jackie Weaver, Cleopatra Coleman, and Ed O'Neill. FX's Clipped. Streaming June 4th. Only on Hulu.
Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between, offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
I think the sea is possibly the most overrated destination on earth. Whenever I'm on holiday and there's a choice between beach or pool, I never pick beach. When you get close to the sea and the seaweed and the stench, and then you get out there and the jellyfish, I hate the sea.
I love looking at the sea, but I also have an unbelievable fear of the sea. Now, there's a couple of things sort of ground me in this. First of all, my grandfather, who was captain for the Merchant Navy in World War II, was torpedoed in World War II and went down. He died. Bit of confusion in primary school in that I used to go around telling everyone he'd been harpooned. Which was quite a different story. My mum was always having to correct me. It's like, no. So today's episode, we're talking about this, a life at sea. That's what we're talking about. It feels early doors, like we might not be the people that are best suited to this.
But I think we are, because of my hatred for the sea, I've always been fascinated by terrible stories of stuff that happened at sea.
Yeah.
And I've always... I once went on... I got the ferry to Santander once on a holiday, and it was really rainy on the deck, and I was running around chasing my brother, and I slipped, and I hit the edge of the boat. Like, I was never close to going overboard. But in that moment, like, it really struck me. That was 300 years ago, and I went overboard. You've got no chance.
Of course.
Absolutely zero chance of pulling through that.
No.
Yeah.
You'd land in the sea, and you'd think to yourself, someone needs to invent the Coast Guard now.
It'd be annoying that you came up with the idea as you hit. You go, why did I come up with this earlier?
As a matter of urgency, someone needs to invent the thing I've just imagined.
But also, the other astonishing thing is that a lot of the time they didn't bother to go back and try and save you.
Really?
No, yeah. That I've got a real issue with that. I would be lying there, in the water, floating as best as I could, treading water as best as I could, just thinking to myself, this shows a lack of empathy.
Yeah.
If everyone on that boat over there, currently sailing away from me, could put themselves in my position, I would really, really appreciate that. Because, got to be honest, I'm frightened now, and I'm cold.
And I can only see the situation getting worse.
Yeah.
Also, like, it's a bit like it's a bit like being sucked out into outer space. But the benefit there is you die instantly, like your head explodes, whatever. In the sea, you've got the ability
can
to keep
your... Yeah.
Just the head. Yeah.
Just the head.
So the helmet stops working when you're sucked. Okay, fine.
I haven't researched what happens in outer space.
Yeah.
But like, in the sea, you've got the ability to keep yourself alive for potentially days.
Yeah. There's food swimming around you for a start.
Yeah, delicious.
You're quick
delicious
enough.
Delicious cod.
So a delicious cod floats past you, and then some delicious batter, and then a delicious fryer, and then a delicious plate, knife and fork, salt, vinegar, and tomato ketchup. We're looking at life at sea this week, so I thought I'd choose pirates and piracy, because there's a slightly odd quirk about piracy, in that a lot of very world-class pirates happen to be from very near where I grew up. Wales is very good at producing some world-class wingers, your Ryan Giggses, your Gareth Bales, and pirates. So three of the characters from Robert Louis Stevenson's novel Treasure Island were based on the Welsh pirates Harry Morgan, who grew up in Llanrymly, Black Bart, Barty the, as he was known in Welsh, John Roberts, who's from Pembrokeshire, and Hoel Davies, who was also from Fishguard, which is also in Pembrokeshire.
Do the films Pirates of the Caribbean sort of bite a little bit? Should be sort of Pirates of Penarth?
Pirates of Newport.
I think there's room for Welsh actors in Pirates of the Caribbean.
It's a missed opportunity.
It annoys me that they went for the big Hollywood names. So the golden age of piracy is the 1650s to 1730s. And yeah, we produced an awful lot of top pirates. And the interesting thing, I think, with pirates is that they came from all sections of society. So you might be a landowner's son, but if you weren't the firstborn and you didn't inherit your old man's fortune, or if you were a farmhand, you just thought, well, it's probably better to be a pirate than to do this. This is rubbish. So the one I'm really interested in is a guy called John Roberts, Bartholomew Roberts, known as Barty the Black Bart. And he was a world-class pirate who stole a lot of ships and stole a lot of stuff. But he's quite a curious bloke because he only drank tea. He was an abstainer. He was a Sabbatarian, so he didn't like stuff to happen on a Sunday. And
it's the weird thing I was just thinking about pirates is like having rules. Because by your very essence,
of rules.
You are lawless. There should be no rules.
Yep.
To create rules.
He allowed no women aboard his ships. Any man who brought a woman on board disguised as a man, that was punishable by death. He allowed no gambling. He was a pirate who didn't like gambling, so he wasn't allowed to gamble at cards or at dice.
Right.
That couldn't be played for money. He strongly disapproved of that. He had musicians on board, and so every pirate on his ship had the right to demand a tune at any hour of the day or night.
It's like early Spotify.
Yeah. Apart from Sundays, when Spotify was turned off.
That's probably more like Napster if he's pirating it.
Yeah.
There you go.
Very nice.
So you could
just go up to them and say, I want to hear, what would it be?
Murder on the Dance Floor by Sophie Ellis Bextor. Yeah.
Get Lucky by Daft Punk. Please.
Yeah, yeah. And then they'd have to get the violins out and approximate it as best as they could.
Yeah.
And he really looked the part as well when he was dressed for action. So he was a tall, very dark. He used to wear a rich damask waistcoat and breeches, a red feather in his cap, a gold chain round his neck with a large diamond cross dangling from it, a sword in his hand, and he had two pairs of pistols hanging at the end of a sling that was flung over his shoulder. He kind of looked like a cartoon pirate, but he was a Welsh bloke who used to run chapel services on a Sunday.
So do you think that a lot of this, I guess, is about controlling his crew, isn't it, really? That's what it is. It's about feeling that your crew's going to be unruly and trying to, I imagine that's what it's, where it's stemming from, isn't it? Trying to create some kind of structure and organisation where you fear it sort of imploding and mutiny.
And they
stuff.
Were pissed all the time.
Exactly, yeah.
Because it was impossible to take large supplies of water on board with you. So you would drink rum. I mean, that's a sort of cliche that's born out of real life.
I found a list of Martin Frobisher's second voyage to North America in 1577. There was a list of all the food that was prepared that the men could have per day. Do you want to hear it? Each day you would get 1 pound of biscuit, 1 gallon of beer per man per day, 1 pound of salt beef, oatmeal and rice,
that's a lot of
pound
beef.
Of butter and 1/2 pound of cheese per man per day, honey, a hogshead of cooking oil, and a pipe of vinegar. Well,
it's
I think the cooking on the vinegar.
It's like a really mad bag on Ready, Steady, Cook, isn't it? See what you can do with that. A gallon of beer is a bit much. I'm not sure I need that, Ainsley, but...
a day.
That list is like... How is everyone not constipated
They used to eat a lot of fermented vegetables and things. Because the problem is, if you're on a ship for months and months, it's impossible to keep anything fresh. Everything would go mouldy.
Yeah.
So you'd have lots of cured meat, biscuits. Biscuits was a staple diet. And then fermented stuff if you could get hold of it. But it's not an ideal way to live. The reason that the pirate diet doesn't exist is because it was a very, very bad diet.
Imagine you go around someone's house when they've got a gallon of beer there, a pound of salt beef, a pound of biscuit. What are you eating here? It's the pirate diet.
Yeah,
not hurt.
Gwyneth Paltrow looks rough these days, doesn't she? Yeah, she's pioneered the pirate diet. She's got awful scurvy. she's ill a lot.
So
it's quite cool she's wearing an eye patch these days.
What is it? A pound of meat? Is that what it was?
That's a pound of salt beef.
I suppose they're doing quite hard work, aren't they? We're thinking about the amount of calories that we burn in modern life.
That's top podcasters.
Yeah, exactly. Where we walk to the shops or post a letter or something. But they're battling the elements. They're sort of pulling ropes. They're doing, you know, so they're clearly burning it. So maybe it's not for me to judge. I don't want to body shame a pirate.
No. Did you come back from being a pirate and did people go, "Whoa, you look great. Have you been away?" Or did they go, "Bloody hell."
That's why they grew those massive beards, Ellis, to hide how much weight they put on. So this guy, he's running a strip ship then, Ellis, this guy.
Yeah, I just think it's really funny because...
What's his name again?
Bartholomew Roberts, Black Bart. Because he'd grown up in a very religious place and he sort of took that with him. And I think he did have... So he had a sort of a normal legal job. And then the ship was captured. And he was initially a reluctant pirate. But the ship was captured by another Welsh pirate who was from down the road in Pembrokeshire. And they spoke Welsh to each other. And he persuaded him, basically, to become a pirate. And Bartholomew Roberts is said to have been reluctant initially, but quickly came to see the advantages of this new lifestyle. And so it was a great opportunity. So someone said that, someone reported him as saying, "In an honest service, there is thin commons, low wages and hard labour. In this, plenty and satiety, pleasure and ease, liberty and power. And who would not balance creditor on this side when all the hazard that is run for it, at worst, is only a sour look or two at choking? No, a merry life and a short one shall be my motto." So he was like, listen,
it's
like
Freddie Mercury.
Yeah, he was like, he was like, "I can either get my head down and work and probably die at 51, having had quite a shit life, or I can die at 37, having had a really, really exciting life. I'll just have my sort of, you know, stomach blown off by a cannonball. And I will cross that bridge when I come to it." So he opted for a short life full of excitement.
So they would have become quite wealthy then, obviously. There was a lot of money.
I'm not sure. The interesting thing is, it's not... You imagine that it's sort of gold that they were stealing and treasure, whereas often they were stealing things like grain and molasses, which is a slightly less sexy version of being a pirate, isn't it? It's like, "God, I'm a great pirate." Oh, yeah, yeah. What have you been stealing there? Loads of grain on the way to Portugal.
When kids are playing pirates, you never hear that in a playground. "Hand over your molasses." Yeah.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Whether you're making a delicious family meal or a post-workout snack, choose the farm fresh taste of Eggland's Best eggs. Only Eggland's Best hens are fed their proprietary all-vegetarian feed. That's what makes their eggs more nutritious. With 10 times more vitamin E, 25% less saturated fat, and 6 times more vitamin D compared to ordinary eggs. Eggland's Best. Better taste, better nutrition, better eggs. Visit egglandsbest.com to learn more.
I love a lift. The higher the better. Absolutely love it. I went up to the 11th floor last night and I was like, this is living.
Where were you?
I was in a hotel in Cardiff and I got to the 11th floor and I thought, I've made it.
Were you staying on the 11th floor?
I'm staying on the 11th floor, baby.
Oh, you were? Okay, you weren't on the second floor and you thought, I'm just going to enjoy the lift.
No. I wasn't exploring.
Okay. My dad was so scared of lifts that he would never go on them. So the family would get in a lift if we're in a hotel and we would go up to whatever floor and then we just have to wait for him to walk up the staircase.
Wow!
Yeah, he was so scared of them. He refused to go in them.
Have you ever been stuck in a lift?
No, have you?
No, No.
Oh, okay.
But I have got a weird thing where I've been in lifts, me plus one other really famous person a few times in my life. Adam Sandler.
Wow.
David Schwimmer.
Wow.
Gordon Brown.
Wow.
So, then that might be it.
And did you say anything in any of those situations?
Nope. I just went, oh.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I did when I got in a lift with Nigel Farage once. Oh. And I did exactly the same thing with Carl Froch.
Yeah.
They're my two lift people who I've been in lifts with. Oh.
So, I'm going to start by taking you back, okay, before I talk about this Paternoster lift and how it changed everything. So, the modern elevator can trace its roots back to Louis XV Versailles Palace in 1743. So,
that's too early. That's too early for a lift. That's too early. Don't like it.
It's amazing. His lift was called the Flying Chair, and it required...
I think I see what's happened here.
Oh, yeah, he'd also invented the flying chair. That's the other thing, which I'm surprised to take off. So it required the user to pull on a rope to raise himself up or down. Would you like to guess why he had this installed in the Versailles Palace?
Was he a big lad?
He was a big lad, but that's not the reason. Well, it's kind of on the outskirts of the reason. He had it installed so he could visit his mistress's apartment, which is on the floor above his, without having to use the stairs. So he was quite a lazy guy and also didn't really want to be seen going around the palace.
How's that less lazy than the stairs?
Well,
if you're doing it with sort of hand power...
Well, it had counterweights, so maybe it was quite a smooth action.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Right.
It does make me think, though, how sexy is that? Will that be you appearing slowly, like sort of the love lift on Take Me Out into someone's bedroom, possibly naked? Which is the next question. Are you arriving naked when you go up to see your lover? Sat there on the chair going, I'm ready.
I think tiny pair of pants.
Yeah. In case she's not alone.
Yeah, not quite naked. But yeah, exactly. Certainly not fully closed.
But did you say that's working? Someone's pulling a rope, basically.
You'd sit in it. It was like a little cabinet, basically. You pull a rope, and then you would slide up to your lover's room.
Oh, you pull it yourself.
You pull it yourself, that's the thing.
It's quite hard work, isn't it?
I still think that sounds like more work than walking up the stairs.
It's like your arms are doing the work, aren't
I also imagine that it was... I imagine it was quite squeaky, so other people would have heard. So I'd be thinking about... I'd probably, let's say you finished quite quickly. You don't want to be going down, squeaking your way back to your bedroom and everyone going, well, that's been 3 minutes. I'd probably go, after I'd finished, I'd say, should we chat for a bit? And then I think I'll probably see you down in about 10 minutes.
Yeah. Should we chat maybe a 3-course meal? Do you fancy a curry?
So, that was the first lift, but it wasn't until the mid-19th century that lifts really started to gain momentum, because this was the time when buildings started to get taller and taller, and most notably the E.V. Haugwalt building in Manhattan, which opened in 1857. It was 5 stories tall, and it was there that they set up the first ever passenger elevator. It was installed by a guy called Elisha Otis. Now, the reason this was put in wasn't because it was hard to get up those 5 stairs. It was because there was a shop in there and the guy wanted to draw people to his shop. It was called Haugwalt's Fashionable Emporium, which sold cut glass and fine chandeliers, stuff like that. And he just wanted people to visit. So it's kind of a tourist trap. So the reason the first passenger elevator was set up was simply as a way to trick people into his shop, which I kind of think shows sort of lack of faith in your merchandise. Are you thinking, we need to think of a way to get people in here? Well, let's just come up with a new way of travel. This lift was, if you're interested, was powered by steam. There's a steam engine in the basement, which would kind of worry me, I think. I'm not sure I'd want to get on a steam-powered lift, especially with only 5 flights of stairs. You know, I think I'd probably walk it. But the crucial thing was, this then led to further inventions in this field. And there was a Liverpudlian architect called Peter Ellis who had a different idea. He wanted a lift, basically, that could deal with lots of people and in quick succession. And when in 1864 he was asked to design the Oriel Chambers, which was a 5-story building in Liverpool, he came up with this invention called the Paternoster Lift, which was first installed in 1869. And this lift has had a huge impact on the way cities are today in the life we lead. So the thing about the Paternoster Lift was It never stopped. So it never slowed down. It didn't have any doors. It just had loads of compartments that were constantly going round on
like
a
ski lift.
Like a, yes, but forward stepping. So you're facing. So you basically step into, like stepping into a cupboard, but that cupboard is on the move. And it will slice your legs off if you get it wrong.
I've just realised what a paternoster lift is.
Yeah.
And that, I've never seen one in real life, but I know about them. They are terrifying things.
Exactly. So passengers had to step into these little cupboards, basically, and they had to time it right, and they had to leap out at their own peril, making their own judgments about timing, because it wouldn't stop. It would just go. It would go past your floor onto the next floor, and you just had to jump out and in at the right time. It was really easy to get wrong. I mean, do you think you'd risk that? Would you?
Do you know what? I've only been skiing once, and I was hungover, in my defence. So I'd never been. So they started me off on a sort of child slope, and I got good enough at that. They said, you can do a blue run on your own now, but you need to go on a ski lift. I was like, oh great, that sounds like good. It was on some day, I can't remember how long, but I'd had a couple of lessons.
Yeah.
They said, have you been on a ski lift before? And I rather arrogantly said, oh, I'll work it out. Anyway, it was explained to me how to get on and off a ski lift, at which point, let's face it, my attention started to drift. I got on the ski lift all right. And it was like a proper ski lift in a sort of in a big resort in the Alps somewhere. But when it came to getting off the ski lift, I realised I'd not been listening and didn't know and kind of blagged it, which was absolutely impossible to do. So I sort of got off the ski lift badly. My skis got caught. I don't think I'd got off the seat properly. I can't remember if you meant to unclip yourself. Either way, I got everything that you could get wrong. And I had to be... to be rescued by a blow. Obviously, it's still going. Now, if I don't get off, the drop obviously becomes exponentially bigger, at which point it looks like I'm sort of facing death. So I got
Are you sat
rescued.
On the seat at this point? What have you managed to do? You have got your bum on the seat.
It's okay, like fine. Being dragged and all this kind of stuff. And I reckon I was probably 3 seconds away from serious injury. And I know it was bad, and I know I should have listened, and I know that the bloke was angry with me because he was so furious. He took his gloves off and threw them at me in disgust.
In cold weather as well.
Yeah, yeah. And swore in a language I didn't understand.
Yeah.
And then I thought, right, just pretend that didn't happen. And then it was awful. It was absolutely awful. But yeah, and do you know what? I never told Izzy that. And she'd been skiing lots of times, so fingers crossed she doesn't listen to this episode because it was very, very embarrassing. But yeah, so when it comes to the paternoster lift, no thanks.
Well, this might not reassure you. In the Czech Republic, they've earned the nickname of the Elevators of Death. That's what they're doing.
Oh my God.
There.
God.
But Imperial Germany became obsessed with them, basically, because they were obsessed with matching Britain and America for everything, and they installed them everywhere. And even today, where they've disappeared basically everywhere, there are still hundreds in operation in Germany, even though they continue to injure people. Some stats here. Their overall rate of accidents is estimated as 30 times higher than conventional elevators.
And
Germany saw an average of one death per year due to paternosters prior to 2002. So since they've invented...
Wow.
One person a year in Germany has died on one of these things.
Do you know what, Tom and Chris, obviously we're all parents. You know the first time you take little kids, really little kids, either on an escalator or on the tube or on the metro in Paris, or any kind of metro, getting them on and off the train is terrifying. And getting them on and off the escalator, you just think, I cannot mess this up. A paternoster lift. Can you imagine taking any kids on a paternoster lift? Ready? 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 Sit! Oh, my God!
Not only would I never do that, I would say to my kids, you are never getting in a paternoster lift. I don't care if you're 50, 60. Yeah. It's not happening. I can't believe, Tom, you're giving these stats. Because I've always suspected there must be a fail-safe. There must be...
Yeah.
I thought that those lifts surely have somewhere. They must be so sensitive.
Can they not be made of jelly or something?
Well, the fail-safe in Germany and in the Czech Republic actually is because if lots of tourists have started visiting these elevators of death and trying to get on them, they've now put barriers in front of them, because they're often in official courthouse buildings and you know, those sort of things, so you have to basically tap in to get to them. So if you work there, you can go on them, but they've basically stopped tourists going on them.
Right,
so
okay,
that's the
you're
plan.
On a stag. You're on a stag. It's day two. You're a stag in Germany. Yeah. Everyone's hungover. You're the organiser, the best man. You see the elevator of death as a potential tourist attraction.
That's like an Inside Number 9 episode, isn't it? Would watch. Would absolutely watch.
Do you go, that sounds like a laugh? Or yeah. Do you say, no, we're going to go to the pub because it's absolutely mad? I would never, ever do
never.
That.
Because you also know there's one of the lads on the stag is going to do the thing. Oh. He lies down and he puts his head out and he tries to put his head back in just before it goes.
Oh,
yeah.
Dave.
So that's
this, is, this is freaking
ultimately,
me
out. It's not good enough because you're just on a lift.
It's, and you've got to get
off
again.
Get it, even if you get it right,
dangerous.
It's hardly the thrill of a lifetime. It's just a bad thing, but with added jeopardy.
But the crucial question is, how did the Paternoster lift change the world? So why was this invention so important? And there's two reasons. First of all, before the lift, and I thought this was really interesting, the top floor in a house or a building was considered the worst place to live. Lugging yourself up the stairs just to sleep below the roof was considered unhealthy, dangerous, like as bad as a cellar, basically. But the lift changed that. The lift is the reason. The penthouse is now the place that people want to live. It meant it became this accessible area, and then suddenly you're looking at views, you're looking at the wonder of all that, and it completely changed the value of, you know, property, basically. And secondly, and this is far more important, lifts proved that humans could build upwards and made navigating these buildings possible, which in turn then made cities more and more dense as kind of property owners tried to develop taller and taller buildings and maximise square footage. So without the invention of the Paternoster lift and other lifts like that, cities would not have developed in the ways that they have now. They're the reason we have high-rise and, you know, New York and Shanghai and London, all these places look like they do.
How
is because of the invention of the lift. It allowed us to build up, to cram people into small spaces, because really, you know, build a building which is 60 floors high, if there's not a lift in it, it's not usable, is it? And that's the important impact it had. Amazing.
How interesting.
Can I ask a question? So we know now people are dying on Paternoster lifts. Can I ask how? Is it, what, are they getting their heads caught? What's going on there?
It doesn't give the specifics.
Do you know what? Don't tell me.
Do you know, can I surprise you? Most of these sort of government-based statistical readings or things like that don't get into the nitty-gritty of how
the
people died. Yeah.
Oh, I mean, it's obvious, isn't it? Yeah. It's obvious.
Is it?
Oh, God. Sorry, I'm reading about it now.
Oh, no.
It's mad that any of them exist. I would have assumed they're all gone. Because they're crazy. They are crazy. How can you trust anyone?
Yeah. Also, you'd think, I mean, this, I sound like an old person who's got a very specific set of political leanings, but you would think that health and safety culture would have nipped the Paternoster lift in the bud.
That is true about the health and safety, though. I know what it's about. It was actually that the health and safety team, they worked on the top floor and people were too nervous to go up.
There's a 150-year-old man with a massive white beard waiting there, thinking to himself, we haven't had a single complaint.
So I've been reading about marriage in medieval England, which, for those who don't know, sort of ran from the end of the 5th century to the start of the early modern period, which is 1485. And it's kind of interesting because it's a period when official marriage became sacred and sort of modern wedding rituals and traditions we have today first appeared. And also, it's interesting because it's completely insane. So it is mad what happened. So in early medieval England, sort of like initially marriage wasn't like a religious affair. So you could get married anywhere, like in the road, in the pub, at your mate's house. This is what people used to do, wherever you wanted. You didn't need witnesses either. You didn't need a priest. All you needed to do was give your consent. So people would say, do you want to get married? And you go, yeah. And then you just, if you both wanted to do it, then it could just happen then and there if you agreed to it.
That's it, it's done.
That's literally all it was.
The old getting married in the road without having to have any witnesses seems quite convenient. I quite like it. I think the medieval English have got some in right.
Planning a wedding is quite stressful as well. It's expensive.
Yeah.
It's really fun. The day was really fun. I got married, as you say. You were both there about a month and a half ago. I really loved it, but it's a lot of work.
A lot of
work. Could have just done it in the street.
And you don't even need a priest. You just need to say, do you want to do it?
Could have done it outside Superdrug.
So this is what people used to do. In the early medieval period, they just say, do you want to get married? Or they maybe have a couple of people there, but often they just wouldn't bother. They wouldn't have anyone. It would just be an agreement between two people. But the issue with this is it caused problems if at a later date, one of them claimed it never happened.
Oh, of course.
But that means every marriage has a get-out clause, because you can just deny it.
Exactly, which is why in the 12th century, the church made it a holy sacrament that had to be observed by God. So basically the game changed at that point, because people were constantly trying to get out of marriages and just going, I can just say no.
Lived together for 18 years.
Three kids together 20 years. No, we're not.
Because no one in Halford heard us agree to get married that afternoon last week. Or whatever. You can just sort of claim.
Find someone who stood outside St Dundere on that day 18 years ago who saw us do it.
So, in medieval times, as we discussed earlier, sort of the lower classes often they married for love. The wealthy, as we talked about in Rome, they sort of married for money and power. And by extension of that, actually, wealthy medieval children were often betrothed in infancy. So, you would have a child and you would decide what other baby you want your baby to get married to.
My son is 4.
Yeah.
He's not ready to settle down.
Would he be a good husband?
No, he's so into cars.
Yeah.
He's got some single issue conversationalist. And it was, you know, it was cars. It's been cars this month. It was eggs last month, and it was ducks the month before that. So he doesn't even know himself. He's certainly not ready to settle down.
I find that idea quite appealing, where it's like, I don't need to do any of the legwork to find a wife. Someone is going to go out and do it for me, and I'll just turn up.
Well, you'd hope it would be your parent. This is the issue, though, Chris. So it wouldn't necessarily be someone who is looking for the right baby and has your interests at heart, because if your father died and he hadn't arranged marriages for you, for his children, it then became the responsibility of the landlord in the area you lived. It was his responsibility to find you a suitable partner as a child, basically, for when you grew of age.
And he's got fix.
Yeah, exactly.
He's got a lot of stuff on.
Like, when my first house in Cardiff, Ellis, I don't know if I knew you then, when I moved in, my room was up in the roof, and they hadn't finished building the roof. It was just black bin bags across the... And that was like that for like a month and a half. And the idea that man would be finding me... a man who couldn't finish a roof isn't going to really be the person that would actually let me lie in it. Or animals try to get in, and could get in if they really pushed it. So it was the landlord's responsibility. And also they would often profit, because they would sell off your marriage rights, basically.
Bloody landlords, man.
Exactly, yeah.
Landlords from hell.
And then at the wedding, things got sort of even weirder in medieval Britain. First of all, you had the best man. The best man isn't what he is today, you know, goes and gives a funny speech. He was supposed to be
a great stag.
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
Great, what we medieval doing? Stag. No,
your options are the tavern.
Yeah. I'll get him in. It's only mead.
We're going to the tavern two villages over. We're staying over three nights.
Different postcode. Obviously, if it does kick off, big group of lads in a different village, yeah. It's the kind of thing that tends to happen. We will get boiling oil poured over us. So.
I've booked it in for some archery.
And you say, well, thank goodness it isn't paintball. That's the only thing I didn't want. The best man, the person you choose would be the best swordsman you knew, because it was their job to fend off the bride's angry family if they didn't approve or if someone tried to steal your bride. Now, I don't know if you've ever been a best man, but that was your job. You were given a sword and it was your responsibility to fight anyone that had a problem with the wedding, basically.
That's a stitch up. Yeah. That's a stitch up if you know you're going to have a battle on your hands. Isn't
it's the yes, like, to do that now.
In that sort of scenario as well, you probably don't even like the bride. It's also, as a best man, you've got to weigh up how hard are the bride's family.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, this is, I think in my mind, medieval time, basically everyone was hard. That's what in my mind, that's what it is, because it's such a tough existence back then. I don't think people were. I think it was just naturally in your character, surely, wasn't it? That fighting was such a way of life.
Yeah, I guess like that's evolution, isn't it? It's just hard people are just the ones who have survived, so everyone's going to be hard.
I think basically anyone who lived pre-central heating is hard.
Yeah. I'd agree with that.
I do feel that, compared to me. But things weren't easy for the bride either at the wedding. So the maddest thing that happened at the wedding is the bride's dress was associated with good luck. And often at the end of the wedding, the entire congregation would chase her and try and rip bits of the dress off her. Ideally, the garter, because the garter was the thing you wanted. And apparently, if you handed that to your lady, it would mean you would then go on to have a successful and faithful marriage.
I hate to bring sport into this, but at the end of the 1970 World Cup final, fans get on the pitch and they're stripping the Brazilian players for souvenirs. And I can't remember who it is. It's someone like Jairzinho. They get off his socks, his shirt and his shorts. And he's shitting himself because they're going for his pants. And he's fighting with them because he doesn't... That's my friend Mike put it. He doesn't want to show his knob to a TV audience of a billion people.
Oh, that's the stuff of nightmares. The stuff of absolute nightmares.
She's being stripped by feral football fans in front of a TV audience of a billion people. Get off me.
That is so anxiety-inducing. As a bride, knowing you've got that moment ahead of you all through your wedding day, when does
absolutely.
It start? Is there a formal beginning to the chase?
So this would be after the wedding celebration, basically, and before you
go
to your marital bed.
She's full of cake and pissed.
Absolutely, yeah. It's just after the speech is ended, basically. The final speech ends with 3, 2, 1, go, and then she sort of just sprints. But people say this is where the tossing of the garter comes from, because that's one of the feelings. It might have been that basically you toss your garter away to try and make the crowd run off in a different direction briefly so you could get away.
Fuck.
So this is possibly where that idea came from. I mean, surely you absolutely... If I was a bride heading towards that, I'd go into an intense period of training
before.
I'd be on the track every morning for about six months.
Walking down the aisle in spikes. A pair of Adidas spikes, track shoes.
The congregation going, oh, God, look at those calves.
Yeah. It's very odd.
First of all, very micro wedding dress, yes, completely clinging to me, so I'm as aerodynamic as possible.
Why is she dressed like Flojo?
But it was part of the. It was completely acceptable to be quite aggressive about this, and part of that is they thought it sort of helped to whip them up into a bit of a fervour ahead of consummating their marriage. So there's also this idea that it was all right to be quite rough and really just tear huge parts of the wedding dress away. So this is what happened during the service. It wasn't kind of particularly dignified either for the bride. One of the things that often happened in medieval weddings, the father of the bride would give one of the bride's shoes to the groom, who would then tap her on the head with the shoe as a show of authority. I don't know what that is.
As a show of authority.
It's so
need
undignified.
To do that.
Someone tapping you on the head with a shoe is nice. I think that's the least dignified thing you can do.
Also, it's like, it's medieval Britain, so that shoe is covered in shit.
Yeah, and it's made of wood.
It's a clog.
Feels like being hit on the head with a mallet.
I was born in 1980, and I don't think I'm cut out for society prior to about 1978.
Yes.
It just all sounds nuts.
This next bit is the worst bit of all. This is a bit that I think you'll agree none of us or anyone would enjoy most much, which is that when marriage became a holy sacrament, it became very important that it was consummated. So after the ceremony, the congregation would follow the couple to their marital bed, and either stay outside or often come in and gather around and watch them consummate the marriage.
Oh, my God.
Now, the idea being it was proof. If it ever came up that it was consummated, they could say, well, we have witnesses.
We have 40 witnesses.
We have 40 witnesses, that thing.
Man.
So people would gather around the bed. Some of the family would lift the groom in. Other friends and stuff would lift the bride in. And then they'd sort of, like, start cheering. And they'd lose their virginity in front of 40 people, basically.
Oh, my God.
Too shy for that.
Yeah. How do you think you'd manage in that situation? And would it affect who you invited to your wedding?
Yeah, no family.
We're
doing no family for this wedding.
Yeah, I'd have to say I'm so sorry, Mum. You can't come.
No.
We'll have a nice meal. We'll go to the tavern. We'll have a nice meal, and you know,
you'll
we'll
get to see together, all but this the isn't pictures, all the photographs. They'll all get put on Facebook. They're for you to keep.
But this bit is not for you.
Yeah.
So there we go, you've had a taste of Oh What a Time, the history podcast presented by myself, Chris Skoll, with Quickly Kevin alumni, Ellis James and Tom Crane. We love making the show. We hope you've enjoyed that little taste that you've got there. New episodes every week. If you want to check it out, it's called Oh What a Time. Please hunt it down on your podcast app of choice. And there may be a gap coming up in your podcasting selections, given the demise of Quickly Kevin. So maybe that could be a nice filler. Hey, you decide. It's called Oh What a Time. We'll be back for more Steve Bruce chapters very soon on the Quickly Kevin feed. Thank you for listening. Until next time, Robbie Slater. See you later.